Our guest today is Richard D. Wolfe. Welcome.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, we're happy to have you in Santa Fe. You're here as a guest of the Lanham Foundation, and you are the author of this wonderful book, Capitalism Hits the Fan, The Global Economic Meltdown, and What to Do About It. Now, you've been professor of economics at UMass Amherst.
Right.
You teach at, what, City College?
No, it's called the New School.
The New School, of course. And you have been delving into economics for years. When I've watched your DVD, which is also called Capitalism Hits a Fan, and then this book, and I thought, they say economics is a dismal science, other than your conclusions. You make it so entertaining and so lucid that it is not at all dismal with you at the helm. So tell us, what is the crisis that we're in, and how did we get here?
Well, I will, but let me start by asking you not to be angry at the messenger. I'm just the person telling you how we got to this situation, not the person who made it happen this way. I'm afraid I have to say what I think most of your viewers already know. This is the worst economic crisis that we've had in the United States since the Great Depression, which means it's the worst in 75 years, which means it's the worst in almost everybody's lifetime who could be watching this program or sharing this conversation. And I think the first thing to say about it is the profession of economics, as well as our political leaders, did not see this coming. They do not know very well how to handle it, and the proof of that is in the pudding of the fact that we are now in the fifth year of this crisis. It really began in the middle of 2007. It's still going on. In fact, it looks like it's about to get worse again. And so clearly the set of policies, those begun by President Bush, those continued under President Obama, haven't worked. We don't know how to handle a crisis of this proportion. And so the prospects are not very good either. And I think the honest thing to say to the American people is we are in a tough position, and one of the few things that we can really do is to be honest about how we got here, to be honest about the problems we face, and to be open about thinking in terms of solutions, programs, a little different from what we've been used to, because that's what this situation, so terrible now, requires. So if I have your leave, let me tell you a little bit about that.
Yeah, you do have my leave. You had some statistics that I just want to mention at the beginning. In 1929, the first Depression, the average family owed just a third of their annual income.
That's right.
In 2007, the average family owned 130% of their average income. And now the average family owes 170% of their annual income. And are we rubbing our eyes wondering how we got here? Tell us.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons we didn't expect this, and we don't know why it's lasting so bad, and we don't know what to do. Economists call this deleveraging. The simple meaning of that term is Americans accumulated so much debt that they couldn't carry that now, trying to face a scary situation, Americans are cutting back on their spending in order to reduce their indebtedness. And the effect of that, which makes sense for each family, is to make fewer and fewer goods sold in the market because we're not buying things. We're reducing our debts. We're paying back the banks and the others we owe money to. The result is goods and services are not being purchased, which means people are not getting jobs producing those goods and services, which means that the solution to the crisis is actually making the crisis worse as each family works this out. And so, yes, the debt is an enormous problem. Let me try to explain why we got into that debt. You know, the United States is a unique place, a special place. And it was from almost the time we became an independent nation. From 1820 to 1970, 150 years, the bulk of our history as a nation, wages in America went up every decade. Working people got more money. When you adjusted, we call it the real wage, when you adjust what a person gets per hour of his or her work for the prices they have to pay with that money, the real wage, the actual value of goods and services your wage pays for, went up for 150 years. There's probably no other country in the world that ever delivered that to its working people. It made us believe as a nation that we were charmed, that we had a special place in God's eyes, that we could promise our children a better standard of living than we enjoyed, that it was upward and onward, that if you worked hard and you did what you're supposed to, you would do better because it was in the cards of the way this country worked. The truth of the matter is we had a very successful capitalism. Companies were successful, made money, invested it back, and grew. But the reason they paid higher wages was simpler. We had a perpetual labor shortage. We didn't treat the people who the Europeans found here very nicely, so there weren't those folks around to do work. And so we had to bring people, most of our people, over here by offering higher wages. So one of the reasons you have higher wages is to bring the waves of immigrants here. Then we discovered that because our country is so large, not only did you have to pay higher wages to bring a person, but to keep him or her working along the East Coast particularly, you had to make it worth their while not to leave and go west and become a farmer and get the relatively cheap land. And so the wages kept rising. And a peculiar culture developed in the United States of a belief in that and a confidence in that and a celebration, understandable under the circumstances. But now, with me, try to imagine what it means if a country for 150 years enjoys rising wages for the mass of its working people, and that suddenly comes to an end. In the 1970s, it stopped, and it never resumed. So, for example, here's a statistic to take home and think about. If you adjust for the prices we pay, the average American worker today gets a quantity of money for an hour of his or her work that is no higher than what it was in 1978. For 30-odd years, we have been a nation that no longer pays its workers a rising real wage in terms of what it can afford. Now, the reasons are not that anybody was a bad guy. There was no conspiracy here. What we call the labor market changed. American corporations began to do two things that reduced the amount of labor they wanted or needed to hire. Computers replacing people. I like to give the example of the supermarket that used to have a lot of people to keep track of how many boxes of cereal we took off and how many paper cartons we bought. All that's done by a scanner, as we all now know, done by one person sitting looking at a computer, can reorder everything every supermarket needs. So we replaced workers with machines. And the second thing American business did is move abroad. We know that story too. To get more profits by hiring cheaper workers in other countries, American corporations closed shop here and opened it elsewhere. Those two reasons, computers and export of jobs, reduced the number of jobs companies wanted. At the same time, we had two new events that are perhaps important in your part of the country more than others. Number one, a mass of American adult women moving into the labor force, wanting paid jobs just like their husbands and increasing the number of people looking for work, and a vast increase in the immigration from South America into the United States, again, looking for a decent life, as all immigrants have. You put those two phenomena together, reduced people needed, more people looking, and American businesses did what all business schools teach their young men and women to do. If you don't have to pay higher wages to your workers, don't do it. And so American business did what is built into their job. They stopped raising wages. Again, to make a complicated story simple, it traumatized us as a people. All the more so because there was no national discussion. We didn't have a debate. Nobody said, let's talk about what we do as a nation if 150 years of rising income, which we became accustomed to, is no longer available. Instead, each American family handled it as a personal matter, often feeling as though it were their personal fault that this had happened. There was a failing in them, rather than understanding this as a social event, which might have happened if there had been a discussion. American working people did two things. They went to work with doing more hours. You know, if you don't get any more per hour, well then, do more hours. Men took a second or third job. The women went even more into the labor force to keep up the standard of living of the family. Old folks came out of retirement. Teenagers began to do more work on weekends and so forth. You had an explosion of labor, which produces the following amazing statistic. Americans do more hours of paid labor per year than any other working class in any other industrial country, including places like Germany or Japan and so on. So we are an exhausted people. By 2007, we were exhausted with the physical work we do. Our families were stressed because the women who used to hold the emotional life of families together were now as exhausted and tired from their paid labor as their husbands were. Stress between wives and husbands, between parents and children, reached a very profound point as indicated by many statistics, our divorce rate compared to other countries, the amount of psychotropic drugs, antidepressants, tranquilizers, all the rest that we consume. We're not by nature any more prone to those things than any other people, but we're under unbelievable stress. The last thing the American working class did is the most crucial. Over the last 30 years, when they couldn't deliver the American dream to themselves and their kids the way they had been led to expect, even by working more people more hours, they undertook the biggest growth of borrowing money that any working class in the world has ever done before. We've never seen that before, not in this country and nowhere else. Americans borrowed like there was no tomorrow in order to keep up the consumption which your wages no longer allowed you to afford. We even invented new gimmicks. You know, up until the 1970s, the only people who had a credit card were businessmen and women who traveled for their companies. In the 1970s, to handle the demand for credit of the American working class and to make a bundle of money for the banks, we became a country, the first in the world, to distribute credit cards to everyone, to college students, to anyone who wasn't dead. We even had those jokes when it turned out there were dogs and others who had acquired a credit card. So by 2007, we had a working class in America that was exhausted, stressed with their family tensions, stressed with a level of debt they could not support. For 30 years, the debts went up, but the wages, which in the end have to pay for them, didn't. And so when you put all that together, when 2007 comes, we have a major collapse, kind of postponed from what should have been dealt with in the 1970s. That's one reason why it's so severe. The other side of the coin is to look at what happened to employers. For 30 years, the situation for them was, in a sense, the obverse, the reverse of what it was for most working people. For them, they didn't have to pay their workers any more per hour. Meanwhile, the workers became more and more productive. But at the same time, year after year, the employer didn't pay them any more. You know, you don't need to be a rocket scientist or to have a PhD in economics to understand that if the employee produces more and more for the employer, and the employer doesn't pay the employee anymore, the profits are going to explode. And the last 30 years have been a bonanza in profits for employers. So our political culture changed because the mass of working people, those who supported often the old Roosevelt idea, the New Deal, and all that kind of welfare state, all of that, withdrew from politics, and in came a business community, all gung-ho about its profits and how they were taking the nation to new heights. So they began to speculate. They began to get excited about the money they were making, which looked fantastic and was very large. And they did what people normally do in that situation. They became a little greedy. They became a little bit too confident. They invented new technologies of instruments, credit default swaps, asset-backed securities, all these things that we don't need to understand that much about. They're speculative devices. And they're all premised on the basis that the American system would work. The problem is, it didn't. Eventually, what anyone who thought about it would have understood, you can't keep borrowing on a flat wage. The American working people could no longer carry their debts. They began to default. And when they did, the whole house of credit cards, all those instruments that the rich had speculated with, collapsed with them. And so we've had a downturn, but it's not your normal downturn, not a matter of 6 months or a year, and then we come out of it. We have our bit of hard times, and then we can't, because this is not one of your normal run-of-the-mill things. This is, in a sense, the end point of a long history of the United States that went for a while real well until the 1970s and then stopped, and we postponed it by borrowing. But that time is now over, and now we have to face what our whole history has brought us to, a situation in which the mass of people do not earn enough, given the way they're paid in this culture, to sustain the standard of living that we have, and corporations who have gotten used to making big money, who make even more money when they go abroad, are looking at the United States as a decreasingly interesting place to do business. And that only makes the problem worse. And we have to deal with this in some basic way, or else we're looking at a long-lasting crisis Let me remind folks, the last big one like this started in 1929 and was not over until 1939, 10 years. The last big one to hit a major industrial country, Japan, hit them in 1989, and they're still in it now. 20 years of economic depression in Japan. The idea that we don't have these anymore, that that kind of a problem is behind us, that's been blown to smithereens by what we're in. So it's very serious, and I think the first step in an honest dealing is to confront how serious one's problems are.
Well, you explicate that so clearly, and two things really kind of grab me. You said if we had been able to have a national discussion about what's going on, but instead, you're right, nobody talks about it. And where were the professionals who would bring this discussion? Where were the economists? Where were the heads of the business schools? And where are the historians who say, ahem, look at 1929, look at FDR, look at the New Deal, look at this, all the when the government hired workers to make all these infrastructure improvements. How come that discussion, I mean, other than your book and a few other economists like you, people are not bringing this to... We could deal with this if we could just look it in the eye, name it, and talk about it.
I think it's a great question. I think the answer, which may distress some folks, is pretty clear. We have engaged as a nation in a kind of exercise of wishful thinking. And here's what I mean. If you're a historian, if you've ever studied the capitalist system that we have in this country, you will know that it is extraordinarily unstable. It has a long history of bouncing up and down.
Boom and bust.
That's right. That's where we develop words like boom and bust, upturn, downturn, prosperity, recession, depression. We have an immense array of words because we have a lot of experience with this situation. So the reasonable thing would have been to say over the last 40 or 50 years, we're going to have these. We're going to have them pretty bad sometimes. Sometimes they'll be short and shallow. Other times, though, they're going to be deep and long because that's been our history. But we didn't want to do that. We didn't want to face that. Partly it was our struggle with the Soviet Union, the Cold War, and all of that. We wanted to believe that capitalism was the greatest and the best, and we got enthused about it as a nation. And we didn't want to look at the other side of the coin that our own history should have told us about. And many of us, you know, were alive or have parents who were alive in the Great Depression. It's not as though it's ancient history. So I think we didn't want to face it. That was the first thing. Talking about the economics profession, of which I'm a member all my adult life, I think it had the same kind of thing. We as a profession became, as professors of economics, less analysts of what was going on than we were cheerleaders of what was going on. We were constantly explaining as a profession how capitalism is efficient and how capitalism meets the needs of the people that it serves, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in some ways it does that as a system, but we couldn't face looking at the ways it doesn't. And I think the best way I can teach this to people is when I was a graduate student years ago going to school, we had in the curriculum a program, a course called the business cycle, where at least we studied the ups and downs in the past, how bad they were, what governments and others tried to do about them, so that a student graduating had some sense of this. Nowadays, if you look at the curriculum of most economics departments, there is no such course. We thought we had won that. We had fixed that. We had overcome that. And so as a profession, we didn't teach it. And one of the reasons our government is so poor, both under Bush and Obama, in dealing with it, is that the economic advisors telling them what to do are thus the generation of students who had no course in the business cycle and never really came to terms, particularly with the arguments about it.
There's so much to talk about this. You're going to have to come back. But so, in effect, what can we do, both as a civilization, as a culture, as Americans, and then as we as individuals, how can we protect ourselves from the boom and bust cycle? Particularly, we're worried about the bust cycle when things crash.
Right. I think I go back to the thing I said at the beginning of our conversation. We have to be prepared to ask questions and look at options that are not those that we have been comfortable with up until now. So let me explain what I mean. The first thing, if you want to get people to have jobs, and if the private sector doesn't do that, for whatever reasons, good or bad, then the only remaining option at this point is for the government to do that. And let me tell you who first said that. Franklin Roosevelt, President of the United States, 1934. He went on the radio. We had no TV then yet. Went on the radio and he said to the American people, if the private sector either cannot or will not hire the tens of millions of Americans who need and want to work, then the government has to do it. From 1934 to 1940, Franklin Roosevelt's federal government created and filled 11 million jobs. If you adjust for population, that would be 22 million jobs. Now, that would basically be it for our unemployment problem. And when the question came up, well, where's the money going to come from to hire and pay all these people? Mr. Roosevelt smiled and he said, well, we have very rich people in America. He came from the Roosevelt family, which was one of them. You have very rich people, very big corporations. They don't have much to do with their money these days because our economy is so down in the dumps. So the government is going to have to get that money from them in order to hire the people, which, if we put them back to work, will be good for those companies and those rich people too. And he went to the rich and he said, you're going to have to pay. The rich were all up in arms. The Republican Party of his day fought him the way the Republican Party is fighting Obama now and so on. But Mr. Roosevelt persevered, and he basically said something that we ought to think about. He said, you know, if you don't do what I want, give me the money to hire the people that you won't hire and to save our system, then there are people coming down the road who are going to treat you much less nicely. The trade unions that were organizing, the CIO that was sweeping America at that time, the socialists, the communists, who were organized and important in American history at that time. He was able to tell the wealthy, deal with me because it's a lot better than dealing with them. And enough of them bought it so that we had the following. Just because when I say this to American audiences, they look at me. Here's two things that Roosevelt did. Number one, you have to pay high income taxes, very high. Number two, I think that we ought to have in America a maximum income, $25,000 a year. In 1942, in the middle of the war, he proposed a maximum income. He went on radio, wow, and he said, I'm not going to send troops to fight a war to save all of us, paying them $600 a year. That was the going salary. When I have to face them and say there are people in America who are not taking the risks for this country that those soldiers are, and they're making tens of thousands. So he went to the wealthy and he said, I'm going to pass a bill. I did the arithmetic. What would that be today? $300,000 a year. Every nickel over that, the government would take. Maximum. They freaked out, the rich people, as you could imagine, but they made a compromise with him. And here was the compromise. The top income tax bracket of the United States, so the richest people would have to pay, was 94%. In exchange for there being no maximum income, they agreed to pay that. Americans don't know. In the 1950s and 60s, the top income tax bracket in the United States was 91%. For every dollar over $100,000 a rich person got, he or she had to give the government 91 cents. They got to keep 9. The same rate today, 35%. That's a tax cut nobody else has ever come close to. If you want to know what Roosevelt's solution was to put people to work and how to pay for it, we don't have to look at a socialist experiment. We have our own history that will give us one answer.
And we have 1 minute. What can we as individuals do?
The first and most important thing is not fear to ask the questions, what has to change in America to get us out of this problem? Every president since Roosevelt has promised that his measures to deal with economic downturns would not only get us out of that downturn, but would make sure we don't have any in the future. By that standard, every president deceived himself and us. We have to be able to ask questions like, do we want an economic system that works as follows? The mass of people come to work, they do all the work, but all the decisions about what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, what to do with the profits, are made by a tiny group of people, a board of directors with 15 or 20 people who are selected by major shareholders, another group of 20 to 50 people, whatever they are. That's a system that is fundamentally undemocratic, and we believe in democracy. If we made our production systems democratic, we might not face the network of crises that now engulf us as a nation.
Well, I'm right now extending to you an invitation the next time you come here to explain to us how we get from where we are now to that vision that you present. But I think what you're saying, that people should ask questions and
educate, not be afraid of those visions, and figuring out together how to get there.
And to educate themselves, which they can start to do by reading Capitalism Hits the Fan. Our guest today is Dr. Richard Wolff. Thank you so much for joining us. It really fascinating went like that.
Thank you very much for inviting me and for the courage to air these questions now that our country needs it so obviously and so badly.
Yes, thank you. You're listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. I'm Loreen Mills, sitting in for Mary Charlotte. We're going to take a break now. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned. Today we continue a very important discussion with Richard D. Wolff. Thank you for coming back, because I didn't get enough. You have degrees from Harvard, Princeton, Yale. You're a professor emeritus in economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. You teach for
the New School University in New York now.
And you are the author of this groundbreaking book, Capitalism Hits the Fan, and it is, we all know that, the global economic meltdown and what to do about it. Well, in our last interview, we talked about the meltdown, but we didn't get to go into enough about what to do about it. So tell us what to do about it, and tell us this, and I'm really going to let you talk. This is a huge problem facing the world, and yet there has been a taboo. Nobody talks about it. They talk about these little tiny manifestations of it. But it's a huge, worldwide, global economic meltdown. What can we do?
Well, I think you're onto something by saying we talk about little parts of it. I'll give you an example. Many of the media still talk about it as a quote-unquote financial crisis, as if it were limited to or just involving banks and insurance companies. But it's a crisis that is affecting the entire economy, not just in Wall Street, but in Main Street, not just companies, but also working people, not just the private sector, also the government. It's everything. Everything is not working very well, and the different parts, instead of helping each other to make a cohesive system, are actually making it worse. Our political gridlock worsens the economic system, and the economic system's problems are part of why we have political gridlock. That's why I tend to stress it's a system problem. It's not this one or that one. It's not the bad bankers or the bad folks who took out a loan that they couldn't afford. It's a system in which everybody was doing things to make their situation work the way they used to, but now the system was making it all end up being a problem. So I stress that because I think it is a serious problem. It hasn't been addressed in any kind of systematic way, which is why we're now in the fifth year of this crisis with no end in sight, with the reports from Europe, for example, that they're even in tougher shape and in a more emergency situation. And as they solve their problem, it will impact us, just as our crisis helped to produce theirs. So it really is a system that is not working.
I want to talk about Europe in a minute. It's one of the main points I want to talk about. But I just want to have a little word for the American worker, because Americans work so hard, and they've pretty much done everything they were supposed to. They put away for retirement. They bought their home. And then with Enron, suddenly people's retirement vanished. And then people, invested in these their retirement funds. We've had it in New Mexico. Our employee retirement funds and our public education funds invested in all these strange financial items, new concepts, and we lost tons of money. But the American worker, they can only think, well, we'll get two jobs, and my wife will go to work, and then, our teenager's old enough, and we'll send him to work, and they're just pedaling as fast as they can. And yet the downhill slide is seems inexorable.
Yes, and I think that's a symptom of a system that's broken. We used to say about capitalism that it's a system that delivers the goods, and that even if it has some wrinkles and even if it has some flaws, it's delivering the goods. And for a long time it did, but it doesn't anymore. It's delivering us one bad after another. Look at, for example, that our federal government is not hiring people to solve the unemployment problem. It's cutting back everywhere. it's not helping people to feel better about their future by knowing that their pensions and their old age will be taken care of. It's cutting Social Security. It's cutting Medicare. It's cutting the supports. We're in an economic system that is in greater trouble than it's been for 75 years. And our government, which should be helping us through this difficult time, is all about cutting the services we need more than usual and saying that there's no end of that in sight. It's a very grim situation, and I don't want to be the bearer of all bad news, but you would have to live in a fantasy world not to confront the reality of a crisis that is now not only not being fixed and solved by our political authorities, but there's a good argument that they're making it worse. And that's a sign of a system that doesn't work.
We can take a minute here to compare the Great Depression and what FDR did with what's happening now in terms of the workers, the bosses, and the government. Just quick.
Okay. It's radically different. Let's take the working people. In 1933 and 4, 2 or 3 or 4 years, depending on how you count, into the Great Depression, the government faced a society in which 20 to 25% of the workers were unemployed, even worse than it is today. The unemployment was lasting long, although not as long as it's lasting today. We're worse in that way. And the working people got very upset. And here's what they did that was very different. First, they joined trade unions by the millions. We had the biggest explosion of a trade union movement organizing workers that we've ever had in American history, bigger than anything before or anything since. It was called the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organization, and it swept people into trade unions. We had many Americans joining socialist parties and communist parties, and these were all expressions of a working class which felt betrayed by a system that was throwing them out of work in record numbers, and their response was militancy and left-wing political activity. Look at it today. We have a working class stung by unemployment, stung by home foreclosures where they're losing their homes. And what do we see? Passivity, non-involvement, turning inward, resignation. And for the few that get involved in politics, they're more likely to get involved in the Tea Party than they are in anything on the left end of the political spectrum. Radically different. Look at the government. Roosevelt, who came into office as a balanced budget conservative Democrat, radically changed. In 1934, he decided to have a government employment program because the workers were unemployed and the private sector wasn't hiring anybody. And between 1934 and 40, he created and filled 11 million federal jobs. He put people back to work the most direct, straightforward way you could by hiring them, giving them a job, making them feel better about themselves, giving them an income that allowed them to maintain their mortgage payments so you didn't have a housing collapse, etc. And what do we have now? We have Bush and then Obama saying we're going to rely on the private sector, we're going to give them inducements, and we're going to give them tax cuts, and they're going to do the hiring. They haven't done the hiring for the last 3 years. That's a policy that didn't work in the 30s, doesn't work now. The difference is, in the 1930s, a Democratic president changed gear. Today, that president doesn't do it, and I suspect it's because he doesn't have the pressure from below that Roosevelt had, from the unions and socialists and communists. We don't have those things in America today, and as a result, the government isn't pushed in that direction.
Well, the jobs bill that, you know, just recently, the president has come out with a jobs bill again that rewards small business and business for doing the hiring. It's no direct things like the WPA, the CCC.
Nothing of that sort.
And with the infrastructure needs that our country has in terms of roads and bridges, it just seems that anyone could figure this out. We've got the materials and the equipment. We've got the huge number of unemployed.
Right. It's a sad, sad thing. You know, the stimulus program that Obama put into effect right after he became president was about $800 billion, a big stimulus program. It didn't solve our unemployment problem. So the one he proposed the other week is about $400 billion, half the size. Well, if $800 wasn't enough, $400 is certainly not going to do the trick. And it's sad to watch because it's condemning millions of Americans to that many more months of being unemployed. And let's remember what that means. If you're unemployed, you use up whatever savings you had to take you through the unemployment time. Since your unemployment check is not enough and will come to an end soon. So you eat up your savings. Then you become a burden on your relatives and your friends and your associates who in a difficult time are now having to help you. And then you get desperate, and then you're willing to work for less money, which undercuts the wages of other people that you offer yourself for less. Every statistic we know, medical statistic, mental health statistic, shows that unemployment is a terrible burden for people. It shatters their self-esteem. It produces anxiety of all sorts. We're condemning lots of people to a level of suffering that should not be allowed to go on, that draws their family, their children, into its own orbit. This is costly to us as an economy for years into the future. So it really isn't something that there should be a lot of wrangling about. It's something that should be solved. And we know from our own history as a nation how to do it, because we've had a president in a similar crisis showing us at least how to make the suffering for millions of American families a lot less than it would have been if he let them live in unemployment the way we're doing now.
And one of the choices that the government is choosing, at least a faction of it, is to actually further penalize the people who are most vulnerable and most dependent on government by cuts in Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security.
It is tragic. We have had a policy of the government which used to be called by the nasty name trickle-down. The idea was if the government helps the banks and the big corporations and the folks at the top, then the benefits will trickle down to benefit everybody else. And as the WAGs used to say in the 1930s, trickle-down never works. It never manages to trickle. It stays at the top. Well, nothing could better describe what we've had for the last several years under Bush and Obama. We've been helping those at the top. We've been providing incentives to the private sector, which is the polite way of saying helping those at the top, and waiting for it to trickle down, and it hasn't done it. And so it is imposing enormous burdens on this society. And there is something to be said about the basic morality and ethics of this. You are helping the people who need it least, who have done the best over the last 30 years. In terms of wealth, we've become a society where the gap between rich and poor has become more extreme. So instead of going to the people who've done the best and who have the most and saying, you must help the rest of your community, we're saying, no, we, the government, going to help you. And when the piper has to be paid, when the cost of that help we're giving you has to be found, we're going to cut back the support for retired people and sick people to find the money. There's something terribly wrong in a system that works that way.
Al Sharpton put it this way on this show. He said, it's like having a fabulous blowout party. Wonderful, wonderful, expensive. And then when the bill comes, to give it to somebody who didn't even go to the party.
That's right.
And expect them to pay for it. But we, you know, there's so much to talk about. I need for us to talk about what can we do about it. And can we look to Europe for possibilities, ways to change some of the things that are going on? So describe, if you would, briefly, what's happening in Europe, and then how we can learn from some of their experiences.
Well, in Europe, in some ways, the situation is similar, and in some ways it's different. Similar is they have a crisis, very much like ours. Indeed, we helped to produce the crisis there, and their difficulties are now making our crisis here worse. So, again, it's a system that is not helping the different parts, but actually collectively making it worse. And so they are suffering all the same symptoms we have, but they react differently. And let me give you an example. You cannot take away from people their Social Security, their pensions, their medical insurance programs, their subsidized education, and they won't let you. They have strong trade unions. We have had trade unions weakening for the last 50 years. They have strong socialist parties, communist parties, green parties, anti-capitalist parties. And when you put all of them together, they are very major political forces. And so whatever happens, you cannot take out the cost of dealing with this crisis on the mass of people. So their personal conditions are simply not the same. I'll give you one example. Every major European country has a national health program that takes care of people, whether they're employed or not. So if you lose your job, which is a tragedy, and that's happening in Europe, it doesn't mean you've lost medical coverage, not for yourself, not for your spouse, not for your children. And so people are insulated from the level of suffering that this kind of crisis produces in a way that is not true in the United States. And that's a big difference. And the irony is, despite the fact that they're suffering less, they're much more militant in demanding a change in the economic system so that they're not put in their suffering. They're out in the streets, for example. Greece, Italy, Portugal, all have had general strikes demanding that they not be made, to use your words, not be made to pay the price of a party they never were allowed to attend.
And the euphemism for these programs, tell me what austerity means, and is that what we're being asked to do here?
Exactly. In Europe, because of the power of the critical forces, the unions, the left-wing parties, they call the spade a spade. They say, you're trying to make us pay with an austerity. Cut social programs, laying off public employees so they can't provide services for people. You're making us, trying to make us pay. That's an austerity program. We will not allow it. Here in the United States, the same thing is being done, cutting benefits, cutting public sector workers. Every city is doing that in America, more or less. Every state is struggling with that problem. The federal government is struggling with that problem. But we call it being responsible, politically, fiscally conservative, all kinds of languages other than the blunt truth, which is we're trying to impose austerity on the people so that the government can take the money and instead of spending it on services for people, use it to bail out an economic system that doesn't work anymore.
So you often introduce your speeches with "Don't kill the messenger," because people do have a hard time assimilating what you have to say. We have been watching the American public react to these things, and like you say, the Tea Party started with a really righteous anger at what's going on, and do you actually think that the people, how much suffering will it take to get Americans to say, wait a minute, this is not fair? Because Americans have such an innate sense of fairness.
Well, I think it's going to take a while. I wish I could give you a prediction. I can't. But I am very confident that the American people will bear with this system a long time. Capitalism has been good to a lot of people over a long period of American history. It gets a lot of loyalty, and that's understandable. And it is hard for people to deal with the fact that a system that they believed in and a system that worked for their parents may no longer work. That's a hard thing to face. I understand the resistance, even to people like me that are explaining what's going on. There's a desire to believe we'll get out of this somehow. It'll be over soon. We'll tough it out. All of that. But I think eventually, when it looks like this is a broken system, that finally the people will realize they have to make a change. And then we will be surprised at the speed with which things begin to change. In the 1930s, they were suffering for 3-4 years, like we have been doing, in a deepening depression. Suddenly, very quickly, everything changed. The president changed, the political system changed, the flavor of discussion in the halls of government changed. And my suspicion is we'll see that pattern again. It'll take a while, but when it comes, it'll be big and it'll be dramatic.
And in this age of mass communications,
it'll spread
really
quickly.
Really be fast.
Yes.
So the generation now is the first generation in America that will not reach the standard of living of their parents.
That's right. And are going to have to face what that means and what it means for their kids.
And you've got kids who went to the good school, got the good education, took out a lot of money in student loans, can't get a job, and they're saying, but I did everything I was supposed to. Like most American workers say, I did it. I sacrificed. I saved. I did all this.
I played by the rules.
And now the game is rigged. The deck is stacked.
Right. And they feel betrayed and they feel upset. And sooner or later, that's going to show up in their political views, in their cultural patterns, in their interpersonal relationships. Nothing is spared from this. And that's why I feel as though I am doing a useful service, even if it's hard to hear, by saying, let's face the problems we have. Because as we know, that's the first step to finding a solution, is to face the fact that you've got a really big, basic problem. It's not going to be solved by this candidate or that one, by this law or that one. We can't scapegoat this group or that group. We got to change a basic system. And hard as it is, not doing it is becoming harder with each passing day.
But that's why I wanted to continue our conversation, because if we don't start talking about this, we are going to be really blindsided. You know, this should be the national debate.
Absolutely. Should have been for 50 years. You know, we discuss in this country whether our transportation system or our health system or our school system are meeting our needs as a people. We debate it. We question it. We ought to have been doing this about our economic system. It's not sacrosanct. If we think that it is, we're making a mistake. If we don't debate and discuss our economic system, we'll be in no good shape to deal with it when it breaks down, which is what we've got. So I think we have to grow up, overcome the taboos of the last 50 years when it was considered somehow disloyal or unreasonable to question capitalism, stop comforting ourselves by saying it's the best system, it's the greatest system, it's an efficient system. It isn't working. And it's silly to keep saying these sorts of things. We ought to have the debate we've been postponing between those who think we can do better than capitalism, those who want to talk about its limits, those who want to talk about its strengths should have their share, and we should have a national debate out of which we should develop a policy that our politicians will have to pursue as to how to do better for the American people. At the very least, fix a broken system, but also be open to the question that maybe there's changes in this system that we ought to think about.
And what we have today is we have some New York Times op-ed people. We've got Paul Krugman. We've got Tom Friedman. And I want to point out that you are just one of many, many points of view. But you have the courage to say, let's talk about it. Let's agree to disagree. Let's look at all of our options. And let's try to fix what's broken. Now, a lot of the alternative systems are totally demonized. And we only have 2 minutes left. But you say that's the worst thing they can accuse Obama of. Socialist, communist. My favorite in all of this was the man with the sign during the healthcare debate that said, keep your government hands off my Medicare, not even knowing it was a government program. Right. Dare we say, perhaps socialized, you know, what? So how can we overcome the demonization of these alternatives to actually then have a real debate? There's strengths in this system. There's strengths in that system. Let's take the best of both.
I think we just have to, and I mean this for all of us, we have to grow up. You know, we don't permit people to dismiss important ideas by putting a bad label on them. That's childish. We did that for too long. Calling it socialist, calling it communist, if all that does is prevent you from looking at those systems and seeing what they have to teach us, you're the loser. We're the loser. We need to interrogate all the systems. It's not as though the one we have is working all that well. It isn't. That's why our millions of people are unemployed. That's why we're losing our benefits, losing our future pensions, facing a future that our kids are going to have a hard time. It's time for us to look at the alternative systems. And we're not trapped in what Russia or China or those other countries. If there are things about those societies we don't want to replicate, let's not do it. Let's be honest and critical of them too. But if I could conclude with one thing, I would like to stress that what a lot of us think is the core problem that has to be addressed is the way we organize the production of goods and services, how we organize our enterprises. I want to stress that the ideas that are emerging now talk about those as the root of the problem. We have the mass of people who go to work and do the work and produce the goods and service. And we have a tiny number of people, boards of directors and major shareholders of our companies, who make all the decisions, what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, what to do with the profits. That's not working well. Those small groups are using the profits to keep themselves in that position. Suppose we think in a new way. Suppose we dare, facing our problems, to ask what would have happened. What will happen if instead of running businesses that way, we made them cooperatives? We made them businesses in which people come to work Monday through Thursday and do their job, but on Friday they sit around and together decide democratically what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits. Imagine, would workers together have allowed a tiny number of executives to get hundreds of millions in salary while everybody else is suffering? I don't think so.
Or would they have outsourced jobs?
Would they have closed their own business and moved to China? I don't think so. Would they have allowed dangerous technologies to be put into effect that pollute the environment where they and their family and their friends live? I don't think so. We would have had a different history, and therefore we ought to look at that as an option for change at a time when our country needs it and needs it badly.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today is Richard Wolf. I want our audience to know they can go to rdwolf.com because you have arguments on all sides of this. It's just, and you have a list of hard questions that people have asked you. There's just a lot of information. And also there's a DVD version of your book, Capitalism Hits the Fan, because we all know it's hit the fan, and we need to know ways to make it better. Okay. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.